interesting parsha, which the truth is doesn't have to do with Eliyahu as much as it has to do with Ahav. But it's a famous story, and therefore I think it bears telling. And Eliyahu does show up for it. So I think it pays. Looking into, even though it's really not too much about Eliyahu. The question about why Eliyahu doesn't feature into some of these stories is interesting. So just to go quickly through the parsha to see exactly what we're dealing with. Actually, I'll take one of those sheets myself. Thank you. I also have to get the books, so this is easier. Sorry, the page numbers, the line numbers that I usually print didn't come out. Just to give you a quick a look to get a sense of what's going on in the chapters. If you turn to Malachim, we finished with Yud-Tet. Oh, you know, there was something I didn't discuss on Yud-Tet, and I think it's important. And of course, with something at this level, it's impossible to really know exactly what's going on, because it's clearly very hidden and secret. But while Eliyahu is on top of the mountain in Perek Yud, Malachim Aleph Yud Tet, as I had before, I don't know if you remember the chart I had last time, there was a very chiastic structure. On the two ends you had Eliyahu drops off his old Nar, and he, on the other end he picks up the new one, which is Elisha. Eliyahu says, I don't want to go on the road, and Hashem says, it's about time to go on the road, and then in the back he also says, time to go on the road. And then coming up the pyramid of the chiastic structure, Rav Eliyahu said, you know, I was a fanatic for you, and this is what I get, essentially. And then on the other side, Hashem also once again asks, what are you doing here? And he says the same thing. The pinnacle is the single verse number 12, I think number 12. And therefore, it pays, 11 and 12. And therefore, it pays just to look at. I don't have any major secrets here, because I think it's really beyond me, but I think it pays to notice. First of all, if you remember where he is the same place where Moshe was, which was in the Nikrat HaTzur, this cave where one is protected from seeing God, so that God couldn't give his mercy rather than his immediate responses in. And in verse number 11 in chapter 19 it says, Vayomer tseva madata bahar, go out of the cave. Leave the cave, which Moshe was told not to do, of course. Va'amadata b'har lefnei Hashem. And stand in front of Hashem. So you can see there's really a very high level going on here. V'hinei Adonai over, God will cross over. Just like, by the way, God, by Moshe says, Vayavor Hashem al-panav, so here it says Hashem over. And that's where Eliyahu is supposed to take a clue. What does he say? And it's difficult to read, so just the verbiage, so I want to translate the verbiage. V'ruach gdola, a great wind, v'chazak, and powerful. I'm not entirely sure what the difference between gdola and chazak is. Chazak is the impression that it can actually do something, which is what it says next. Mifarek harim, it shatters the mountains. Umshaber sla'im, and it breaks the stones. The difference between mifarek and shaber, just from an etymological standpoint, mifarek means it takes apart pieces that are attached together. That is one stone sitting on top of another stone. When it says mishaber sla'im, the idea is that you're talking about a single rock which it shatters. That's the difference between farek, which is to take apart a built entity, and lishaber, which means to shatter something which is a single entity. So here it is, mishaber sla'im lifnei Adonai. That is, the wind is going out in front of God. Lo beruach Adonai. That's how it reads. That is, this great wind that's going to shatter and do damage and it's going to reshape the earth is going out in front of God, lo beruach Adonai, which means the stress is on the last word, lo beruach Hashem, or better yet, switch it, the Hashem lo beruach, which means I'm not in the wind. That is, the wind is going out, it's going to shatter, and it's going to do damage, it's going to take upon the mountain, I'm not there. I'll show you what I mean in a second. Vachara ruach, and after you see this massive hurricane, mountain-eating storm, rash, there will be earthquakes. So rash means a ridat adama. There will be a massive quake.
This is all translated in the past tense.
What?
As if it had already happened.
Is that how it translated for you? Read it. Could you read it?
Read it.
Yeah.
All right. It said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, and behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and broke the rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, it's still a small voice.
Right. So it's actually, it's sort of like a progressive. It's an ongoing tale. I had it where God is actually communicating the entire way, and this is what's saying is he just sends him out to see what he'll see. So that I think that's actually probably better. It's a better translation. So let's go back and continue. So it says, Vachar HaRuach, and after the wind came, past tense, Rash, there was an earthquake. How did it explain Rash? Did it say noise?
Earthquake.
It said earthquake, that's right. V'lo Barash Hashem. Hashem's not in the earthquake. And obviously, when it says V'lo Barash Hashem, the question is, what did Eliyahu see? That as Eliyahu was looking at it, what does he perceive when he sees that God is not in it? This is not just one can't tell that God's in the wind. The assumption is the wind comes from God or the wind doesn't come from God. If there's an earthquake, such as in the time of Uzziah, it was a king Uzziah who committed a sin, and there was an earthquake. So the sense is that God sent the earthquake as a punishment. That is, these things are always indicative of revelations, whether they're positive revelations or negative revelations. Eliyahu apparently can see God or sense God. There's no God. Which, by the way, could be, and I'm just speculating here, is why he's allowed out of the mountain. Okay? Because Moshe wasn't allowed out of the mountain because if Hashem had saw him, he would die. That's what it says. Hashem had to cover it with his hand because lo yirenu Adam achai. So when he goes out and he sees all these things, either he knows that God's not there because he sees it, or he knows that he's not there because he's not dead. Or he understands that the reason why he's allowed to see these things is because God is not in these things. And I'll explain what these things are in a second. Vachar harash esh, and after the earthquakes there will be fire. Lo ba'esh Adonai, God is not or was not in the fire. Vachar esh kol dmamah daka, there is a still silent voice, which is a very difficult thing to translate.
How can Hashem be in anything when he's not physical?
What it's trying to say, I think, and you're right, he's not physical, although we certainly have the idea of Shekhinah. These are three things are matched to the three, to my mind, I'm not positive, these three elements are matched to the three elements that Eliyahu is then told to recruit. He says, go to Aram and recruit Hazael. And whoever Hazael doesn't kill, Yehu will kill. And go appoint Yehu, and whoever Yehu doesn't kill, go appoint Elisha, and whoever Yehu doesn't kill, Elisha will kill. That's his commandment, that is, employ these people, because these people will do the work of God. What won't do the work of God? Neither great hurricanes, nor great earthquakes, nor fire, which are all things really to a certain extent that Eliyahu had sort of employed in himself. It's hard to say that there was a Ridat Adama, although if I'm not mistaken, there may have been a Ridat Adama by Har Carmel, but there was certainly fire that came off the mountains. These are things that Eliyahu employs for his big show, and it works. And I believe what God's saying is, that's not how the game is played. And it's something that I've spoken of before. Go out in the mountain, you're going to see all these great things. These are not the way I do business. It's not a matter of whether God's not really in the wind, because of course he's not. And it's also not a matter of the fact that God doesn't control the wind, because he does. What he's saying is, all of these elemental forces are not the way God does business. How does God do business? There's a war with a guy named Aram, and it changes the shape of politics, and it will have a negative effect on the northern kingdom. And then there will be a Yehu, and Yehu will have a political upheaval, and he will have he'll have a civil war, and he'll win. And after that, there'll be a guy named Elisha who tells Yehu to do business. When Yehu doesn't know whether he's doing right or not, so Elisha helps him out and tells him that he's doing right. These are all subtle humanistic ideas. And I think what the message to Eliyahu is, and I probably said this before, I hope I'm not repeating, is don't be such a kanai. That is, you want fire, you want wind, and you have the sense that if you go out and the earth starts shaking, everybody will say, oh, God is in the fire, and God is in the wind, and God is in the quakes. But people don't say that at all. God's not in the quakes. A quake is in the quake, and God's not in the fire. A fire's in the fire. And God's not in the storm. A storm is in the storm. End of story. Where is God? The cold mamadaka. A small, thin, silent, barely recognized voice. It's a subtle. That's where God is. God is in subtleties. God's not in big flaming shows. God is in subtleties. And I think that's the message. Where Eliyahu says, I was a kanai for you and I did all these wonderful things and miracles. And God says essentially, and I've repeated before, look at it. You see the storm? That's not where I am. You see the fire? It's not where I am. I'm in a cold mamadaka, a little silent voice. And it's there that you find the revelations. And that's what I think at the simple level is happening here. And that's why the three things are contrasted against the three things which Eliyahu was told to do. And that's why ultimately the salvation of Israel, the removal of the Baal worship, does not come by Eliyahu's hands, doesn't come with fire. It comes with a guy named Yehu who comes, and he has a nice little regular political rebellion that I'm sure everybody could look at and not think that there's a thing prophetic about it, spiritual about it. And he burns down the house of Baal, and everybody would just think that that's a political move also. And nobody, that is, you can miss it. You can miss the call to Mamad Dekah, but it happens to be God says that's the way it works. So Eliyahu, as a Kanai, is told that that's the wrong thing. And I think that at the very, that's a very simple level what's going on. There's clearly a lot more going on here. There's much more. There's tremendous, I don't want to say Kabbalistic stuff, because that almost demeans it to a certain extent. There's tremendous spiritual things going on here, and I don't begin to understand them. That's what I just think is the simplest message. That is, it's not in the, God is not in the big booming voices. God's in the little tiny voices. And that's I think, is the simplest message that exists.
He's in both.
Give or take. What?
You have Yetzias Mitzrayim, and you have Megillas Esther.
Well, I think that's what Eliyahu was trying to. I don't know if you remember, we had a chart, all the things that Moshe did, Eliyahu mm-hmm. was. So even though Moshe wasn't a Kanai, although Chazal in that medrash said he was. He wasn't a fanatic. He wasn't a guy who jumps right on your back if you do something wrong. You're right.
You had the maybe. You had the Makos and stuff like that. You didn't just have Hester.
You're absolutely right. And I think it was a one-time event. That it was a one-time event to shatter they were in Mitzrayim for 250 years, a slave generation. So they needed to shatter that generation for all the good it did them. So Hashem pulled off all these miracles to shatter that. But ultimately, the Torah that they got wasn't the Torah of miracles. There were two Torahs. One was the Ketav Yad Elohim. That got shattered, right? That's when Moshe threw it off. And then Moshe goes up again, and he gets one, Biyad Moshe, the one that Moshe wrote himself. So the question is, which one's better? Isn't it better to have the one that God writes? Or it was the Ketav Yad Hashem. Who knows how it would look like? I don't know, the glowing letters, neon color. I mean, it's hard to say exactly what was there. The bottom line is, that wasn't the one that Bnei Yisrael got. You could say because they committed a sin, but they committed a sin because they had to commit a sin, because people can't deal with that kind of threat.
They couldn't handle that, the whole thing.
Right.
And
it could be the human race. Exactly right. The human race can't deal with that kind of thing. And it could be that's what Hashem is trying to say here. I don't, this is pure speculation. Obviously, there have probably been entire treatises, the Zohar, pages upon pages of the Zohar written on this revelation. But I'm not much of a Kabbalist, and all I could, I just read the Fi Pshuto, and maybe that's one shot, maybe it's not. So I want to take you through the next three chapters. We're going to do a quick review of what's going on, because it's very interesting. And that will take us to the end of the book of Menachem Aleph. So just spend 2 or 3 minutes on each chapter. Perek Chaf is a war story. Melech Aram, the Aramites, came to battle Israel. They send this threatening message. Achav's going to bow down, he's going to beg off. And then they set two sending him a message, and they push Achav too far. He asks his people, because he has his people's support. People said, go fight Aram, and they take out Aram. Aram says, oh, you know why you beat us? Because we fought him in the valleys. But if we fight him on the mountains, or vice versa, on the mountains, we fight him in the valleys, their God is a mountain God, but not a valley God. So we'll go fight him in the valley, and we'll be okay. So God then gets very upset at the Aramites. He said, because they dared to put me in a little black box, now I'm really going to take out the Aramites. That's what happens. The Aramites, the king's name was Ben-Hadad. By the way, these characters are well attested to. We have documentation from the Middle East about Ben-Hadad. He was a real king who really fought he actually fought alongside Achav for a while. He fought alongside him. They went to battle in 853. They went to battle with the Syrians that were just starting to move up in the famous Battle of Karkar. This is probably after the Battle of Karkar, when they all come back, and Achav probably feels that they probably feel it's time to turn against each other. Now that the Assyrian threat is gone, now we can turn against our friends and start killing each other. But there is a very close relationship, of course, between Aramites. We're, of course, originally Aramites. Arami Oved Avi. So the way we usually translate is Arami Ma'avid Avi. That is, love and tried to destroy my father. But the proper way, as Ebenezer probably says, is Arami, my father was an Arami, because that's where Avram was from. He's from Aram. Oved Avi, he was lost. He was lost in Aram until he came to Israel. And that's the way either he's talking about Yaakov or he's talking about Avram. But there's really very little question that we are originally Aramites, right? Most, they lived on the other side and they used to worship, and then they came to Israel and everything went much better. The relationship between the Aramites and the Jews is very, very close. They all come from the same racial stock. The language was very similar. So no surprise that sometimes they're killing each other and sometimes they're very close friends. We just get the killing each other part. What happens at the end is fascinating. Ben-Hadad loses the war horribly. He really gets pulverized to the point where he's about to be killed. And this is the part that I want to read you. This is the end of Perek Chaf. It's very important stuff. It is Chaf. Oh, and what's also interesting is that the Navi here at play is not Eliyahu. Eliyahu disappears from the scene altogether. Now, there's no question that Eliyahu is the prophet. Everybody knows Eliyahu is the prophet. And yet Eliyahu disappears from the two war stories. One is in Perichaf and the other one is Perichaf Bet. We'll see that one also. Eliyahu is not at play. An unnamed prophet is here, who, according to Chazal, is Michayu ben Yimla, who is named in the second war story. And therefore, Chazal says probably the same prophet. There's no reason to assume that they're not correct, because Michayu was certainly the big prophet next to Eliyahu at the time. So somebody here shows up and tells Achav that things are going good for Achav. No, I'm sorry, not going good for Achav. That is, somebody shows up and tells Achav, I'm sorry, in this case, that in fact things are going good for Achav, not because Achav is such a wonderful guy, but because the Aramites stink so badly that God is going to punish them. What happens? Let's go to verse... verse 30, I think. Yeah, verse 30. So the Jews win big time, really big. And it says, "Vayanusu anoturim afeka." They ran away to afek ala ir, vatipola chomal esrim v'shivad ala ir anoturim. The war falls down in afek, so they tried to use it as a guardian city. However, the wall falls down. The wall is tossed down. Ben Hadad Nash, Ben Hadad, the king of Aram, who's the enemy of Achav at this point, he runs away. And he runs into the city, room inside a room. According to Barbanel, what that means is he hid in a room under the ground. What it means is he's hiding in a locked room inside a locked room, which means he's in a closet, right? He's shivering behind a closet, hoping that he doesn't get caught. Ben-Hadad is it. This is the time to totally nail the Aramites. This is the fulfillment of the prophecy, what the Navi told them. The Aramites are going down. Now you might say, but wait a second. What about Chazael? Eliyahu was on the mountain and was told that Chazael, the Aramites, are going to change the fate of Israel. Always keep in mind that prophecies, and here's the very important thing about a prophecy, and I know I'm digressing all over the place. A Navi is at his best when he's a Navi Sheker. Because a Navi comes and tells you, if you don't do the following thing, these bad things are going to happen to you. I.e., therefore, ergo, if you do good things, those things don't happen. Right? It's a famous problem with Yonah. Yonah is told, go tell Nineveh that if they don't do tshuva, in 40 days the city will be destroyed. So according to Chazal, one of the things that he was worried about is that he's going to go and they think he's a Navi Sheker. Why? Because they're going to listen to him and the city won't be destroyed. He's a Navi Sheker. It's built into the job description. It's why I'm sure an actuary will be able to tell you life insurance policies for Nevi'im were very high. Because either they brought you bad news that you didn't listen to and you killed them, or worse, they brought you bad news, you actually managed to listen to them, the bad news didn't happen, you figured they were a Navi Sheker, and then you killed them. So really, it's a very dangerous job, right? So never assume that just because a prophecy is given that that's the end of the prophecy. There's, obviously, if Achav does tshuva and plays the game the way it's supposed to be played, then we don't need any retribution, right? You can do, what do we say on Yom Kippur? Ad sof, what's the word? Until your last day, Hashem yichakelo, what's the phrase? I can't remember. Yom Kippur is coming up and I can't remember the liturgy. Hashem waits until the last day for you to do tshuva. You do tshuva, then Hashem is very happy. This is true for Achav and it's true for us. Which means every prophecy that you read in Tanakh, you always have to keep in mind. The fact that it doesn't come true shouldn't bother you. Or the fact that there's another prophecy to contrast, it means that obviously Achav had pulled it together to some extent. He fought for Israel, stood up for himself. And the prophecy changes. It's a very fluid river. You can't really seal yourself into any one given thing. That's the whole point of prophecy. So just that being known. So Ben-Hadad is definitely on the run. And he hides room inside a room. Verse 31. Vayomer elav avadav. So his servants were hiding with him in the closet, I guess. Hine na shamana, we have now heard. Ki malchei beit Yisrael, ki malchei chesed heim. They are melech chesed. They're very, very merciful. They do loving acts. They're nice Jewish boys, right? Nice Jewish boys. Nasima nasakim b'motneinu, will wear cloak as if we're slaves. The chavalim b'roshenu, and what that means is we'll put nooses around our neck, which means that we're giving ourselves off the sign of slavery and subjugation. V'netzei el melech Yisrael ula yichyet nafshecha, maybe he'll save our lives. Well, guess what? They show up to Achav, and guess what he does? He says, okay, I'll give you mercy, which is where the Medrash says about him and about Shaul, who saves the Amaleki. They say, mercy, and it's also in Mishlei, a mercy done to an Achzar that is a mercy done to a person of viciousness, it comes and it turns out in the end to viciousness. But we'll see why it's very important with the whole Eliyahu story in a second. So he says, fine, I forgive you, but watch. See, Achav, just like Shaul, it's not just that he likes Agag, and it's not that he likes Ben-Hadad. Look what happens. Look what the promise is. In Lamed Gimel, I'm sorry, in Lamed Bet, it already says, that he says, Techina nafshi vayomer haudenu chay achihu. He says, oh, you're still alive, my brother. So it looks like Achav already wants him alive, but it's not totally clear. You're still alive, my brother? So he's playing it carefully. Now look what happens in Lamed Dalet. Ben Hadad gets the message, and he says, Vayomer elav, ha'arim asher lakach avi meit avicha, the cities that my father took away from your father in battle, ashiv, I'll give back. V'chutzot tasim l'cha b'damesek, and you can set up shops in Damascus, meaning he's giving him rights for what? He's giving him economic rights to a city, which means that he sets up some kind of a taxation system, and whatever the Damascus being a very important city on the road, so he'll get, I don't know, 20% of everything that comes through will go. Do you see? He's not an idiot, and Achav's not an idiot. Achav's in it for the money, right? Among other things. He's in it for the money, he's in it for the power, he's in it for the politics, but at the very least, he's in it for the money. Kasher Sam Aviv Shomron, do you see what? Just like my father put up these shops in Shomron, which means up to this point the upper hand was with Aram. And the money was being taken out of Shomron, which is the capital city of Achav's father, and being sent to Damascus. Now, part of the deal for survival is you now are in charge, we give you back all the cities, and you're now in charge of the financial situation in Damascus. It's a very good deal. So Achav says, okay. The Navi then comes along and he reads him the Riot Act. He reads him the Riot Act. And based on the Riot Act that he reads him, he says, because you didn't destroy the nation I told you to destroy, you're going to get it good. End of this story. Chaf Bet, if you take a look in Chaf Bet, let's skip Chaf Aleph for a second. Chaf Bet says, Vayeshu Shalosh Shanim in Nochamed ben Aram ben Yisrael, which means this very nice treaty that Aram promised them lasted for a whole 3 years. All 3 years. And now in the third year, Yehoshaphat, which is the king of Judah, is coming together with the king of Israel, and they've decided that they want to take all the land away from Aram. It's time to go to war with Aram. They call together all the prophets, and all the prophets say, go to war with Aram, because God will do it for you. As Yoel Ben Nun said, if every single prophet in the world tells you to go do something, you're doing the wrong thing, right? Because if you have 1,000 people all telling you to do the same thing, it's not possible, not even for prophets, not even for prophets. So they all tell him, so Yehoshaphat is nervous, because he knows a lie when he knows a prophetic scam when he sees one. So he says, don't you have somebody who tells something a little different? So they get Michayu ben Rimlo, which is apparently the guy who read in the Riot Act in the first place. So he says, if you go there, you're going to die. Achav is not happy, so he throws him in jail. Of course, he goes with jail. But Achav is not a total idiot. He dresses Yehoshaphat up as himself. He dresses up as nothing. He dresses up as a Stam guy. They attack Yehoshaphat because they attack Yehoshaphat thinking that Ben-Hadad attacks Yehoshaphat thinking that it's Achav. Yehoshaphat doesn't want to die for the sake of his dear beloved brother king. So he says, I'm Yehoshaphat. So they say, forget it. Alright, don't attack him. We just want him. They're looking for him. They can't find him. A very strange thing happens. Take a look at
Yisrael
and Yehuda get together. They join together to attack Aram. Aram doesn't want to kill anybody except for Achav. They know if they can kill Achav, war's over. They know. Achav's a big player. Yehoshaphat is a very nice guy. He's a very spiritual guy, but he probably can't fight his way out of a can of beans. So all they want to do is take out Achav, and they know that everything will be changed. They can't find Achav because Achav is dressed up like a regular captain. He's on a chariot, but they don't know who he is. What happens? Look at Lamed Gimel. Vayihi, this is chapter 22, verse 33. When the Aramites saw that, in fact, Kilo Melch Yisrael, who they saw Yehoshaphat was not really the king of Israel, they simply backed off. They just didn't fight him. They're only looking for northern Israel troops. Perhaps they didn't want to fight southern Israel. You know, Yehuda, it's hard to say what. V'ish mashach v'keshet lutumo. Now, these words are fascinating. A man drew his bow. Lutumo means tam, which means simply, or without knowing, without understanding what he was doing. Vayaket Melch Yisrael ben Advakim, and he hit him between the plates. He probably had some kind of plate mail. Uven Ashir Yon, Vayomer Barak Kavo Hafoch Yadcha Votena Min Amachaneh Ki Echalati. And then he says, just get me out of this battle area. He's out of the battle area, but they keep him in the battle. And they keep him, they stand him up in the battle so he doesn't run away from the battle. Eventually he dies, and then they call a Tiemp Don Savier. What's the French word for time to run away from the battle? There's a very nice phrase for it. Yeah, it's a famous French word for all hands retreat. Does anybody know, anybody big on these things? I forgot what the exact phrase is. It's all hands retreat, everybody go home. What's interesting is the guy who shot the arrow didn't know who he was shooting for. And Chazal, there is an opinion in Chazal that goes so far to say is that, guess what, it was friendly fire. And there's an opinion that goes so far to say is that it's Yehoshaphat. It's Yehoshaphat. there's a commentator that actually mentions that Yehoshaphat did it on purpose because he knew that Achab was a bad guy. That, I think, is a little bit too far. But one does get the sense that it's friendly fire. Do you see? It's very interesting. The Ish, it doesn't want to tell us who, just a man, an important man, Mashach B'keshet L'tumo, drew his thing without knowing what he was doing, Vayaket HaMelech Yisrael, and he killed HaMelech Yisrael. You get the sense of friendly fire there, actually, something went wrong. You could say it just means that they were in the northern Israel, they were taking pot shots, they happened to kill the king because they didn't know who they were. But one gets a real sense of friendly fire. So essentially, the ultimately bad thing happens to Achab. He's killed by his own, it looks like he's killed by his own people here. So, what we have are two war stories. We have a war story where Achab succeeds, but because he doesn't wipe out Ben-Hadad, the prophet comes and says, you're going to pay the price for it. Your life will be placed for his life. And that prophecy comes true in chapter 22, which continues the war story. In fact, the words, and it was 3 years of peace, then Yehoshaphat got together with Achab. They both felt like they were up for a little more war against Aram. For whatever reason, they wanted more cities back. What's interesting, if you remember, Aram promised that they'd give back the cities to Israel, right? But look at the beginning of verse 22:1. What does it say? Chapter 22, verse 2. Vayhi b'shanah shlishit, it was in the third year, vayered Yehoshaphat melech Yisrael. Yehoshaphat joins forces with Israel. Vayomer melech Yisrael el avadav, hayedatem, did you not know, ki lanu Ramot HaGilad? Ours is Ramot HaGilad. Now Ramot HaGilad is under the Golan Heights, but in the hill area in Jordan, going up from, I'm sorry, I don't have a map, essentially, let's say, right from beneath the Golan Heights, or from the low hills coming out of the Golan Heights, to about, let's say, 30, 40 miles below that. Now, Hadad said, what was he going to do? He was going to return all the cities. Obviously, Hadad did not come clean, or he took them back. It's hard to say what happened in those 3 years. But by and large, there was quiet in the 3 years. It seems to be that the reason for the war, the spark that set off the war into Achav's mind is really Ben-Hadad did not do what he said he was going to do. He didn't give back all the cities. And therefore, it's time Yehoshaphat and Achav now together, we're going to wipe out, we're now going to take care of Achav and Yehoshaphat together. We're now going to take care of Aram that either did or did not keep their promises. These two stories go together. You see what I'm saying? I win the war, but I do a bad thing. The prophet tells me, Achav, I'm going to pay the price. I go to war, I pay the price, apparently with the same prophet. You see how the stories merge together? Inside that story is the story of Navot HaKarmeli. Navot HaYisraeli. It's a story of this guy who had a vineyard. Achav wants the vineyard. He can't get the vineyard. He gets really, really depressed. Yezebel comes around. She takes care of things. Navot is knocked off politically. There's a kangaroo court. He's knocked off. Achav takes the land. Eliyahu comes and reads him the riot act and says, you're going to die. And then we go back to the war story that was interrupted by the Kerem story, by the vineyard story.
So now we have two deaths.
Oh, that's another problem. You're right. Why does Achav, if he already had a death sentence from the end of the war story, why does he need another death sentence from the Navot HaKarmeli story? Who needs it? So again, here's the thing we have to be careful. Not just because you get a death sentence doesn't mean it's necessarily going to come true. If you do tshuva, then that's it. The Gzar Din can be taken away. Although we don't see that here. The last thing that happens in chapter 20 is the death sentence. And then we have this terrible story about how he has somebody killed for his property, or his wife has somebody killed for the property, and he gets another death sentence. It seems to be so interrupted that in fact the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Bible, which is very ancient, written, we only have copies really from the Common Era. The earliest copy is probably about from 250 or 200 of the Common Era, where we actually have some manuscripts or fragments of manuscripts. It was written, however, according to our tradition, there's no reason to doubt this tradition because there are other books that mention the the translation of the 70, and there's no reason to think that the form's not too different. In the translation of the 70, which was a Jewish translation, by the way, when you think of the Targum Shuvim, think of it as the art scroll of the day. People didn't speak Hebrew that well. They started to lose Hebrew. Greek was the language which was being spoken in Egypt at the time. Most of the Jews at this place were in Egypt because they had to run away. They were there from the time that Beit Rishon fell. They ran away to Egypt, and they stayed there. It became a major Jewish center. There was a temple actually built there during Beit Sheni. There was actually a second Beit HaMikdash built by the Ben Chonio, who were evicted. When the Hasmonaim came in, they evicted the old priest. The priest went down. They said, okay, we're going to build another Beit HaMikdash in a place called Niv, which is this little river. It's a little city on the river of the Nile River. Very interesting story, which we certainly won't go into now. But Egypt was a major player for Judaism. It was from Judaism at the time. It was, you know, a real Lakewood of the time, or maybe a West Orange, just to say, at the time. And they needed art scrolls. So the Targum Shuvim was for Jews, written by Jews. Even though now it's been adopted by Christianity, the Christians adopted the Targum Shuvim, and you won't find a Septuagint in too many Jewish... I doubt you go to too many rabbis and find a Septuagint sitting on their shelf, but I can tell you it was written for Jews by Jews.
The Septuagint... You sure it was written for Jews? I thought it was written at the command of
Ptolemy. I'm sorry, go ahead, Brian.
No, there are different...
Right, and the two traditions that we have are actually the rabbinic tradition and a book called The Letter of Aristeas, which was written about 150 years before the Common Era, which is the original story of the Targum Shuvim. The rabbi story is based on that. In the Targum Shuvim, it's a very firm purpose. They're doing it. Ptolemy does want to know what's going on with the Jews, but the Jews also need to know what's going on. They're starting to lose their Hebrew. They need to communicate. The rabbis take a more negative view from it, because by exposing the Bible to the Christian, keep in mind, the rabbis are writing post-Christian. So now that all the Christians can translate the Bible, and they find things in Isaiah, like, I shall build you a new testament, so all hell breaks loose because they have the Septuagint. So the rabbis certainly have a beef to pick with the translation with the Bible, which is sharper than the one written by Aristeas. And the Letter of Aristeas is older, so perhaps one could say that it is less of a polemic. That is, it's written more objectively as a history rather than as a statement against the evils of translating the Bible. I don't want to say that the rabbis were lying or suppressing. The rabbis had a point to make, just like the Hasmonaim. The Hasmonaim were great warriors who protected Jewish people, but if you read about the Hasmonaim from the rabbi's perspective, it's very negative, because they were very upset, ultimately, that the Hasmonaim kept the melucha instead of just keeping the priesthood and giving the melucha to Beit David. It doesn't mean they were wanting to rewrite history. It just means they wanted to make a very important point. There was a religious point to make. They weren't writing a history book. They were writing a religious book. So the Targum Shuvim, getting back to, want to step away from the history, the Targum Shuvim takes chapter number 21, the story of Nabot HaKarmeli, and it moves it in front of chapter 20, which is Eliyahu's story, Eliyahu up on the mountain. Then I've got the Carmeli story, which makes sense because Eliyahu is there. Then Eliyahu disappears for a while, and I've got the war story number one, where Achav's successful, and then the continuation, war story number two, where Achav's not successful. Do you see what I'm saying? It rearranges our Masorah, because our Masorah is at face value a little difficult. The question I have to ask is, well, wait a second, why would our Masorah divide these two stories, which are clearly, the war story one and war story two are clearly, they're verbally connected, why would the Torah, why would our prophet, why would Yirmiyahu want to divide them with the story about Nevot the Carmelite? A new prophet, a brand new prophet, a brand new story, a repetition of sin and punishment. So I think there are two possible answers, of course. The simplest possible answer of why there was a three-year space in between the first story and the second story. So at the very simplest answer, the reason why the Nevot story is put inside is, at the very simplest, is because chronologically it happened then. Right. However, we know that the Torah does not write chronologically. The Torah writes thematically, in Mukdam Mukhar B'Torah. And this is certainly a wonderful time to do what the Septuagint did, which was to take the story and put it in its thematic place. But the Septuagint misses something very, very important, and you'll see that it's not only just an issue of chronology, it's an issue of theme. And here's where I want to take you into some verse work, so let's take a look at some verse work. And let's take a look at the end of chapter 20, where the prophet comes and says, because you didn't kill Ben-Hadad and you let him go free and you think you're going to play a political game, your life is going to be forfeit in turn. This is chapter 20, verse, it's in the 35s. Verse 40 is probably a good place to start. Verse 41 is probably the best place. Mem Aleph. Vayimaher vayasar et ha'efer me'al einav. He was dressed up in this, like he had caked over his face, so that the king wouldn't recognize him as a prophet right away. Again, that's a dangerous business. Vayaker oto melech Yisrael. Apparently, this unnamed prophet is well known. Another reason why one should assume that it's Micha ben Rimla. Also, he hated Micha ben Rimla, so this is a reason to assume that this is Micha ben Rimla. Otherwise, he wouldn't have to dress up. Ki me'anaviim hu. He was from prophets. Vayomer lav. And the prophet says to him, Ko amar Adonai yan shalachtet ish chermi miyad. Because you sent a man who was in Cherem, that's what it means, Ish Chermi, a man who I put in Cherem from your hands, Vayitan nafshcha tachat nafsho, your life will be in place of his life, Va'amcha, and your nation will be in place of his nation. Vayelech melech Yisrael obeito sar v'za'eif, he was angry, he was depressed, Vayavo shomona. Now keep your fingers on those words, sar v'za'eif, and take a look at what happens with the Naval. Let's go now to the vineyard of Navot HaKarmeli right below that. He goes to Navot HaKarmeli and he asks him for Navot HaYisraeli, and he asks him for his terem. He wants his vineyard. He said Navot says no way, can't do it. We'll get into why in a second. And take a look after he says no, what happens to the king? What does the king do? In verse 4, let's start for verse 3. I can't give you the land of my property to you. What does it say? Do you see? It's the same exact words. Just like he left the first prophet, the prophet told him, you did the wrong thing with Ben-Hadad, and now you're going to pay for it with his life. So he went home, Sar v'Zaif. He was angry. That's all we know. He goes home Zar v'Zaif. He can't be too Zar v'Zaif because he's interested in buying property from Navot HaKarmeli. Now he's Zar v'Zaif, but now take a look what happens. He says, Vayomer, he says to himself, he's speaking to himself, he's muttering, Lo atein lecha, he said to me, I won't give you my property, the property of my father. Vayishkav al mitato, this is Achav, he lays down on his bed, Vayasev al panav, he turns his face to the wall, Velo achalechem, he refuses to eat any bread. He's in mourning, right? When he was told he was going to die with the Ben-Hadad thing, he was very, very upset, he went home very angry. Now, when he's told that he can't get a piece of property, now he's so angry he doesn't want to eat any bread. Get the lack of proportions with Achav. But irregardless of lack of proportions, you could see that the Navi knows what he's doing. That is, the Navi is balancing these two stories. So the question that you have to ask in your mind is, what's the relationship between Achav's negotiations with Hadad and Achav's negotiations with Navot HaYisrael? Because you could see that there's the connection. The second connection, by the way, is at the end of the chapter. Let's now go to the end of the chapter, which is that Eliyahu reads him the riot act. This is in 21. His wife has Navot killed. Eliyahu comes, he reads him the riot act, and he says something very strange. Verse, excellent question. Hold on a second. Yeah, probably around that area. I'm looking for the word by Yasset. I didn't come prepared enough. Hold on. Safta, there's the word by Yasset that is she convinced you to commit a sin. Hold on. Oh yeah, there it is. Verse 25. Yeah, which is a weird verse, by the way. Take a look at what's going on here. In verse 20, 21, 22, he reads, Eliyahu reads Achab the riot act, he's going to die. And his family's going to die, his kingdom is finished. Then in verse 24, verse 23, he says, Yezebel's also going to get it. Then he goes back, and he says, Hamet v'achav, this is verse 24, Hamet v'achav ba'ir, whoever dies for Achab of the city, yachlua klavim, v'amet b'sadeh yachlua ofa shamayim. This is the classic, whenever a dynasty is going to end, it's happened twice before with Basha and with Yeravam, this is what happens. And now look what happens. Eliyahu is in the middle of speaking, and look what happens in verse 25. Rak lo haya ki Achav, but there was nobody like Achav, asher hitmaker, who became addicted, lasot hara b'nei Hashem, to do the bad in God's eye, asher hesat oto Yezebel isho, which Yezebel had seduced him, hesati, he had instigated him into doing. The weird thing is it doesn't look like Eliyahu speaking. This looks like an evaluation. Usually at the end of a king's life you have, and you should know that there was no other king like it who was so bad. It looks like Eliyahu's words are interrupted for this evaluation. Where does this evaluation belong? This belongs at the end of his life. By the way, the reason why Acha paid such a heavy price is because we never had another king who was so bad. And all of a sudden we have this word, Hesata, and this kind of like, it's a jump out. Eliyahu's not speaking. God, the narrator, the Navi, gets in and says, by the way, you never saw a God like this who is Hesata. Why is that word Hesata important? Where's the word Vayaset Oto show up? Anybody know where the word, and he was seduced into doing something bad? It's actually a popular word. Usually involves the satan. Right? What does it say? That David, at the end of David's life, he does a sentence. So what does it say? Hashem hesitoto. He had instigated him. And Rashi says, lo yadei amah. I don't know why. The same story appears in Devar Yamin, but it's not God. It is the satan, because written much later, so the satan starts to play a role rather than God. Because I think they were uncomfortable in having the idea that God would do something so bad, so they started to create this sort of anti-picture. In Eov, when Eov comes, he says, I'm going to be mesitim. I'm going to be mesitim. It also shows up in the next... the weird thing happens in the next story, in the war story. What happens? All of the prophets are getting together, and they're all telling Achab that he's going to win the war. And then all of a sudden, Micha ben Yimla comes over and says, I'll tell you the prophecy that I saw. And it's a prophecy very similar to Yeshayahu. I was up in heaven, and I saw God, and he had all this familiar standing around him. And a ruach came, that was the old name for the satan, the ruach came, and the ruach said, I will mesito to. Who yesita dachav? Who's going to seduce Achav? So here we have the idea of seduction, that is, Achav seduced by his own rabbis who were willing to tell him whatever they wanted to hear. So you have this connection on both sides. On the first side, you have this guy who is angry because he doesn't get what he wants. And then at the end of the story, what ties it together, what weaves it nicely together, so you have this guy who's always being seduced. He could always be convinced to do the wrong thing. He's a wonderful guy. He's got the best of intentions, but somehow he's always convinced to do a terrible thing. So now you can see that the story of Nabal HaKarmeli is very carefully inserted into these two parshiot. And now that I have 15 minutes later, now let's analyze, 15 minutes left to go, let's see whether I could actually explain what the story is all about. With a focus on Eliyahu. And I'm not going to be able to do the whole story, so it's hard to tell what's going on. But I'd like to give you a little view into Achav's personality. Let's go to the conversation that Achav has with Navota Yisraeli about why Navot can't give him the land. Oh, sorry. The first question that you have to ask is, Achav goes over to Navot and he wants property. Why? Because Navot has property right next to his throne. He has a palace in a place called Yisrael. It's not his capital city, but it's another significant city. And there's a guy who, it's like a shul, right? I got a big shul. The shul wants to expand. There's a house next door. Let's buy it, knock it down, and we'll expand the shul. That's such a bad thing. It's not a terrible thing. So he goes over to. So he goes over to Navot and he says, listen, I want your property. Mm-hmm. Give me your property. I want it for my palace. I want a nice little guy next to my palace. And what is he promising? He promises to give him back another property, which is better. And if you don't want the property, take money. So I have a question for you. What do you know about the rule of kings? What, in fact, is the rule of kings? I have a question. Who's doing, and what does Navot say? Navot says, go take a walk. I won't do it. So I have a question for you. Between you and me, who's wrong here? Is Achav not the king? Even if the king could have said, Achav's the king. He wants a place next door for his shul. So give him property. What's the big deal? But the moreover thing is, the general conception is that the king has the right to take whatever property. Where do we know that from? Where do we know that the king has the right to take property? What would you say? The Shmuel story, right. So I have that printed on the sheet. So take a look. It seems right here. It's in Shmuel Aleph Perachet. This is when the people are asking for a king. And Hashem says, fine, but you tell them what it means to have a king. Vata Shema B'kolam, very first line, Ke'id Ta'id Bahem, make sure that they know, V'yigad B'an Mishpat HaNoch, it's called the famous Mishpat HaNoch, Asher Yimloch Aleyem. V'yom Shmuel Kol Dibrei Hashem O'am HaShoalim Me'ito Melech. V'yom HaZeh Yiyem Mishpat HaNoch. These are the rules of the king, Asher Yimloch Aleyem. Et B'nechem Yikach, he'll take your boys. The Samlo of the Merkavdol, who make them, who conscript them to his army. Ubefarashav Ratzel with name Merkavdol, who make them the honor god. Pasuk 12. Vilasum lo sare alafim, he'll take them as officers. And also to reap his fields, the katser ksiro, lasho klei milcham tov, will make them forgers, blacksmiths. Now take a look in your gimel. Vepinotechan yikach, will take your wives, l'kochot, l'tabachot, l'fo, to make them apothecaries, and to make them cooks, and to make them bakers. Ve'et sadotechem, ve'et karmechem, and your fields, and your vineyards, v'zeitechem, and your olive orchards, hatovim yikach v'natan la'avadav, he'll give to his servants. You see, Vizar Echem, Vikam Echem, Yaser, he'll take a tith of, Vinatam, Vizar Echem, Lavadav. Which means this is the Mishpat HaMelech, which means Achav, we had this whole big thing. He won't give it to property Achav. Achav's really depressed, and he's able to have some till, but wait a second. Based on this, what is Navo guilty of? What is he guilty of? Mori B'Machu. What's more of Mori B'Machu? Is death. What do I need a kangaroo court for? Navot is totally in the wrong, and that's the problem that we seem to have here. And in fact, that may be Achav's thinking. But let's take a look halachically. I guess Achav didn't agree with the rabbis of the time, and the rabbi of the time being Eliyahu. Let's take a look what the halacha is. This is something that most people don't know, or not as many people know. So let's take a look in Talmud Bavli. You see that it's on the second paragraph. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Rabbi Yehuda says his name is Shmuel. Kol ha'amor b'parsha. Does everybody see that? Kol ha'amor b'parsha the Melech. Melech Mutarbo. Everything that was written in that story by Shmuel, that's what the Melech could do. Rav Amar, Rav says, Lo Nem Rav Parshazu Elalayim Aleihem. Not true. This is only a threat. The king did not have the right to do that. It was just to threaten the people to let them know what they were getting into, to know that, let them know what the king might do, but not what the king should do. And the Gemara says there's a machok between Rav and Shmuel. Shmuel says the king has the right. Rav says the king does not have the right. So first of all, machok etanayim, whether there is such a law. Now let's take a look and see how we pass them. Let's take a look at the Rambam. That's in the third paragraph. Rishut yesh lemelech liten masal am l'tzorchav ol l'tzorcha milchamot. He's allowed to put on a tax. The kotev lo meches, and he is allowed to put on whatever taxes he wants. Vasur lav riach min ha-meches, he can't run away from that tax. Sheyesh l'gzor kol mi sheyignov ha-meches, he'll kach mimeno, etc. O yereg. So essentially, Paskin's like who? Shmuel or Rav? Who's he Paskin? You're allowed to take the property? You're not allowed to take the property. Seems like you're allowed to take the property, but we have to read another part of the Rambam. Let's take a look in the next Rambam, which is actually earlier. Kol, this is the fourth section down, Rambam, Halacha, Malachim, Perek, Gimel, Halacha. Kol ha-mori b'malchut, b'melech Yisrael, yesh b'melech reshut b'hargo. Anybody who's mori b'malchut, you can kill him. Afilu gazar alecha mishar ha'am, sheyelech l'makom ploni. I can go to a guy and say, I want you in Tel Aviv tomorrow, and if you don't show up, for no reason, I want you in Tel Aviv. If you don't show up in Tel Aviv, you're dead. I'm the king. I don't need it. Divine right. I can say what I want. V'lo halach, o shalo yatza mi beito, o shalo yatza mi beito, you shouldn't go out of your house, but yatza, and he goes out of his house, chayv me. Now, obviously, the implication is he's supposed to be going for war purposes. He's supposed to be going to help the king. It's not just supposed to be random, but theoretically, you could extend the law. V'im ratza lahargo yarog, if he wants to kill him, he can kill him. Shnei amar kol ish asher yamred picha. V'chein kol ha-mevazet anelch, anybody who shames the king, oh, Hamacharfo, Yesh Lamelech Rishut Laharcho, Kishimi Ben Gera, by the way, he says Kishimi Ben Gera, not like Navot, right? He doesn't mention Navot. Ve'ein Lamelech Rishut Laharog El Vesayif, if I can only use a sword, Ve'yesh Lo La'asor V'Lakot V'Shotin L'Chvodo, let's continue on to the next bit, Avalo Yafkir Mamon, but he is not allowed to take away his money. Ve'im Yafkir, Hariz Eb Gezel. The Rambam Pasuk is very interesting. He's allowed to borrow the money. He's allowed to make taxes. But he's not allowed to take away the property without question. The Rambam postulates all this by land. When it comes to land, the king, yes, the king could take the land, i.e. the produce of the land, not the land itself. Why can't he take the land itself for the next halach in the Rambam? Anybody who's doing a mitzvah, and the king says, don't do that mitzvah, the king has no right to stop him and he can't kill him. It's not Mori B'Malchut. What does that have to do with the story? Let's now go back to Navot HaKamali and let's take a look at what Navot says. What reason does Navot give him for not giving him the property? Nachalat Aviv. And what's the halacha? Lo Timachev. It's Shmitut. You're not allowed to give the property. He knew that if he was give away his house next to the shul, it's not like he'd be able to get it back in the Yovel. It would be built over. It would become part of the, part of the king's house. He would not be able to get it back. It was a halachic issue. Not only that, look at where he puts the word lach. I cannot sell the property to you. This is fascinating stuff. You get an insight into Achav's mind. Hopefully I'll have enough time to cover all this. I may not. We may have to continue in 2 weeks from now. 2 weeks, by the way, not next week. Verse chapter 21, verse 3. Vayomer avot el achav, chalila li me Adonai, which means he brings God into it. It's a horcha. I can't do this. Mititiyat nachalat avotai lach. Where does he put the word lach to? At the end, which means, what's the real stressor? It's not lach. It's not that I can't give the property to you. It's that I can't chai Hashem. I can't give the property of avotai to you. What does Achav say to himself in his own need for self-justification that he's doing the right thing? Vayavo Achav ubeto sar v'zaif al adavar she diber alav navot Yisraeli. Vayomer lo etein lach et nachalat avotai. What does he do? I won't give to you the property of my father. Do you see what he does? He takes the word lach, which is hanging at the end, a sort of like a prepositional phrase, and he moves it to the center of the verse. Navot didn't say that. Navot said, I can't give the property of my father to you. Achav hears something else, or wants to hear something else. He says, I can't give you the property of my father. Yes, it's not, it's you I can't give it to. You see? He doesn't want to know about halacha, and maybe he's trying to, by the way, purposely avoid the whole halacha issue. He's not a firm guy. He doesn't want to give me the property. That's my problem. What does he say to Ezebel? Look, as the story goes on, it's like playing telephone. He keeps watering down the story of what Navo told him because he needs to justify his own sense of success. Let's continue on. How come you're so upset? She wants him to be a king. Buck up. Be a man. Because right? Without a king, she's nothing. This is what happened. I spoke to Navot Yisraeli. Give me your property. That's not what he said. He said, give me your property and I'll give you another property which is better. Some kind of trade, because he sensed that, okay, he knows you can't give me the property, but if I give you a different nachala, it's a fair trade. He avoids that. What does he say? I'll give it to you for money. It was a money deal. Oh, im chafitzata, if you really want it, which means Achav is saying that the motive for Navo not giving the property is what? First of all, the Nachal Avotai is totally removed here, right? We have no sense of father's property. He says, what was the deal breaker? I'm going to give you money. And lo chafetz b'zeh, if you don't want it, if it doesn't satisfy you, then I'll give you some property. Which means when he retells the story to Ezebel, what is now Navot's reason for not giving over the property? What's the reason? I'll give you, he puts the money first.
Enough.
What?
He doesn't think he's giving him enough.
Exactly right. It's financial. Navot is now not a guy who's concerned about God and his own property. I offered him kesef. I offered him my good king's money printed with my name. And then when he said he didn't want it, I offered him property. He wouldn't take that either. So now he's totally lost the whole halachic aspect of it when he speaks to Ezebel. You see how the story is now being watered down? By the way, it's interesting. Ezebel doesn't even know about the halachic issue. Not that she would really care about it anyway. Ezebel is upset about the financial aspect because that's probably what she understands. But what Achav is doing here, and you get the sense of why Achav is punished the way he is. See, we always have the sense of Achav, we don't know why Achav gets such a terrible punishment. He's always doing tshuva. Right? He sees the thing, he says, okay, I believe in God. I know I did a bad thing, I'm sorry, I apologize for doing a bad thing. We don't get a sense of why Achav's such a bad guy. Here you can really get a sense of why Achav's such a bad guy. What makes him upset? When the Navi tells him this is the way you have to act, and he wants to put his own personal interest in front of it. That is, when it comes to me versus the kingdom, me versus the people, I'm always putting me first. The people say they can't do it. It's not right. It's not halachic. You can't take away tribal property. You'll ruin the whole idea of tribal property. The whole idea of tribal property is that people have a connection to the earth. He takes that and he rearranges. He says, he wants money. That's what he wants. He went against me. I'm going to rearrange the whole thing. So even though, and this is one of the problems, I know I'm rushing, but I want to finish up, and it's tough to do, but we'll just skim over it. What happens? Let's take a look at the end where Eliyahu catches him. This is in verse number 20. Where's Eliyahu? Eliyahu is Yutet. Perer Chapalov actually plus a good giant. But he divided the night of Eliyahu at Tishbile Mor. So God comes to Eliyahu after this whole incident where Navot is killed, guess where Achav goes first thing? Just in case you want to think that Achav's a great guy, because Achav really didn't know about the plot, right? In fact, when Ezebel comes afterwards, she uses very vague words. She said, by the way, you remember that Navo guy? He's dead. Yeah, look at the, actually, look, it's very strange. Look at verse number 25. Achav doesn't even find out that Navot is killed. Vayhi kishmo Yizevel kisukal Navot vayamot, that he was killed. Vatom Yizevel Achav kum resh, go inherit the property. In kerem Navot Yisrael, asher me'im l'tev achav kesef, he wouldn't give it to you with money, right? Because that's what Yizevel thinks. Ein Navot chai kimet. You see that strange double lashon? Ein Navot chai, he's not living, kimet. He happens to be dead. They're avoiding the whole conversation. Don't ask why he's dead. You don't need to know. He's dead. Go inherit the property. It's now yours. You see? Achav is like he doesn't want to know. He wants to, I didn't kill him. It's not my wife. My hands are clean. I never touched the guys. But where does it go? So he doesn't convene a court of inquiry. He immediately goes down to inherit the property. Let's take a look at the conversation. So Hashem tells him to go talk to Achav, and he says the famous words, Haratzachta v'gam yarashta, you murdered. Now, at face value, that's difficult, because did he in fact murder? He didn't. He never murdered anybody. Huh? Who murdered? Yizevel. God doesn't say a word about going to Yizevel. He says, going to Achav, it says, Haratzachta gam yarashta, you killed, and now you inherit? It's obviously a rhetorical question, because whenever you ask these rhetorical questions, it doesn't mean you didn't kill. It means you're trying to get Achav to admit what? That he killed, because obviously Achav does not want to admit he killed, and that's what's going on in Achav's response. Well, let's continue the passage. He says, after you say Haratzachta gam yarashta, v'dibarta elav, and then speak to him again, which is very strange, because he was already talking to him. Kom Hashem bimkom asher lakua chalavim etam navot, in the same place where they're licking the blood of poor navot, yilaku chalavim etamcha gamata. Is this a personal sin or a national sin? Very personal, very personal. Vayomer Achav el Eliyahu. Now what's interesting is, Eliyahu never says these words to Achav. You have to assume that the conversation took place, right? Because Achav is now responding. Hashem said, you, Eliyahu, go talk to Navot, and go talk to Achav, and now Achav is responding. What does he say? Vayoma Achav Eliyahu, Hamatzatani oivi, has my enemy found me? Vayomer, and Eliyahu says, Matzati, I found you. Don't read that as this expression of guilt. The easy way to read it, and I think the wrong way to read it, is, oh, you caught me red-handed. That's not what Achav is saying. Achav is asking a rhetorical question. He says, Hamatzatani avi? You got a smoking gun there, Eliyahu? Show me the fingerprints of my hands on Navot. You won't find them. Sorry, you won't find them. Go talk to the people in Israel. They won't tell you anything. If you want to accuse yourself, well, okay, you already got a fight with my wife. You already want it dead. What do I? That's not my problem. What are you accusing me for? So then Eliyahu says like this. Keep in mind, the punishments were personal up to this point. You did a terrible thing. You need to be punished. Which means whenever a Navi comes to a king and says, you did a terrible thing, think about Natan with David. I'm sorry, I'm going a little over. I'll finish soon. Natan goes over to David. He says the same things. You committed a sin. In which case, what does David do? Chatati Hashem. And then Natan immediately says, okay, Havir chatat chai alai, lo tamut. Now you won't die. So you learn retroactively that it was a death penalty until David said, okay, I'm not going to punish your whole nation because of what you did, David. You did a sin, you're going to pay. And David says, I'm sorry. What does he respond? Satani oivai? Has my enemy discovered me? Now the conversation is different. Now Eliyahu never repeats those words he said in the first place, because Eliyahu is finished with the personal punishment. We're not talking about personal punishment anymore. I already dealt with the personal punishment. You had your chance, Achav. Now let's take a look what happens. Vayomer Achav el Eliyahu, Matzatu Avi, Vayomer Matzati. I found you. I have all the goods I need. Yan hitmakercha lasot ara b'nei Hashem. You're addicted. You're drugged on always doing the wrong thing. The Nevi'im tell you to do the right thing, and you are sold. What is it, by the word, when kor means to sold, it has a financial connotation. Why? Because as I mentioned before, why did Achav make the deal with Hadad? It wasn't because he liked Hadad, but he was friendly with Hadad. He wanted to put his own shops where? In Dimeshek, which is what Ben-Hadad promised. It was a financial thing. He wanted the finances to override what God's law was. Here too, he wants the property of Navot. Not only that, he can't even understand what Navot's saying to him. He thinks Navot is also talking about money, maybe. So what happens? Look in Chaf Aleph. What does Eliyahu say? Hinani mebi elecha ra ubiarti acharecha. I will destroy you and I will destroy after you. V'hichrati l'achav mashtim b'kir v'atzur azur v'yisrael v'natati et beitcha kebeit yiravam. The punishment is no longer single anymore. After Achav has been told, Achav refused to admit personal guilt, then what does Eliyahu come and say? Like prophets always say to kings that refuse to admit personal guilt, that's it, the dynasty is over. And you can take a look in the next words. They're the same words that were told to Yeravam, word for word, the same words that were told to Baasha at the end of his dynasty. You think you're such a hotshot? You think you got such a powerful army? You can't admit personal guilt? You're finished. There's nothing to talk about. Achav refuses to admit who he is. He's addicted to the whole committing the sin thing. And because he does that, Eliyahu, by the way, Eliyahu is not making this up himself. He says, Hashem says that he told him to say it. But we don't get that at the beginning, because all we needed to hear is that Hashem said, go take him and tell him about his personal sins, and then we had a personal punishment. Because that's all that could have happened, was the personal side of it. When Achav refuses, but in his back pocket, of course, Hashem told him, and by the way, if he refuses to admit it, here's the second message. So we hear from God the first message, because that's the hope that Achav will respond to it. When Achav doesn't respond to it, we get the back pocket, which is Eliyahu pulls out his other prophecy and says, you don't say you're sorry for the personal things, you can't, you're drugged, you're addicted to it, then I'll tell you what's going to happen to your wonderful, powerful kingdom. You've had it, your host. And what happens is, that's when the next story takes place. Because, remember, in the first story with Ben-Hadad, he was punished. He was told that because you gave mercy to Ben-Hadad, you're going to be punished. So the question is, how come he's getting another punishment here? Because of the same punishment. Remember? Why did he commit a sin with Ben-Hadad? It wasn't because he wanted to be a nice guy, because he wanted to do chesed, because he wanted money. And the money blinded him to religious law. He refused to do it. And by the way, did Ben-Hadad ever give back the property to his people? Never gave back the property. He promised he would never give it back, which means essentially by Achav putting, but I'm sure Achav had his stores in Damascus, which means by Achav accepting the treaty, he was guaranteeing himself that in 3 years what was going to happen? A war where people were going to die, which means Achav was refusing to pay attention to his national responsibilities for the sake of his personal greed and desire. It's not that there's another punishment here. It's the same punishment. It happens to be Achav's getting another chance. What you're looking at is the Ben Adam v'Chaveiro part, as opposed to Ben Adam v'Makom. You look at the Ben Adam v'Chaveiro part, but it's the same disease. It's literally, he's sar v'zayif. Whenever he finds out he can't get his money deal because God says he's doing the wrong thing, whether it's coming out of a Navi or whether it's coming out of a frum guy named Navot who's read the Torah and knows that he can't sell his property, he's very upset. Don't give me frum. Don't give me the Torah. I want my money. So the punishment is not a second punishment. It's the same punishment. And that's why you need to know about his personal failures before you find out why he actually dies in battle against Hadad. Because had he only done tshuva, which he couldn't do because he was so addicted, then he would have been able to survive. And that's essentially why we have this one story of Nevat HaKamali sandwiched inside the two war stories, even though probably the two war stories could be put together. I'm not entirely sure what the point of the story was. I'm not sure what it was really about Eliyahu. I think it was more about Achav, but it's important to understand him.